This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll explore what it really means to achieve wellness. We'll ask a specialist in integrative medicine. Plus, the struggle of living with COPD and the support that can really help. But first, how women can still have a vaginal birth after a cesarean section. The overall cesarean section rate in the United States has increased from just under 21% of all deliveries in 1996 to nearly 33% in 2011, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But if you've had one, does that mean you must deliver that way for the next baby? Here with more on this is Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and the director of academic midwifery program on the community campus of Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Heather. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda. Good to see you.
So first, help us understand, what is this vaginal birth after cesarean? It's also kind of known as a VBAC?
Correct. VBAC, which stands for vaginal birth after cesarean, which means that a woman who has had a prior cesarean section delivery, as long as she is a candidate, is able to have a trial of labor and attempt a vaginal delivery. So they call it VBAC, vaginal birth.
So basically, as in any labor, it's hard to know if that's going to work. So there's always the option, it seems, being held out, that they still may then have to have a cesarean section.
That is correct.
And a certain percentage, probably a pretty high percentage, still do have to go on to have a cesarean section.
There's certain criteria that women would have to meet in order to be a candidate for a vaginal birth after cesarean section.
Let's talk about that. What makes you one a good candidate?
Most important is we need to make sure that we know where the scar is on the uterus. So a transverse scar.
Which means
that...
Horizontal?
Horizontal, correct. A horizontal scar on the uterus, which has always been written in the operative notes. So we can get those records to determine what type of scar was placed on the uterus.
I think that's an important point, though, because I read somewhere it's not necessarily what you see on the outside of your belly, so to speak, because that may be a different type of scar than actually was done inside on the uterus.
Correct.
So you can't know that by looking yourself.
Correct. No, you have to know through the operative note from the surgeon who performed the surgery.
Okay. So then a transverse uterine incision, rather than the classical one, I guess, which is vertical, like a T-shape one. Right.
The T-shape is definitely contraindicated, which means you have both a vertical and a transverse incision. There is a possibility that if you do have a vertical scar that you may be a candidate, but you need to have that conversation with your provider at the time that you discuss VBAC.
Right, and I think we'll continue to remind listeners, obviously, that that's all of this needs to be discussed very, very carefully in a case-by-case basis with your own physician.
Correct.
But so what are some of the other things that might make you a candidate to try it?
Your willingness, your interest in wanting to try a vaginal birth after cesarean section. Obviously, this is your choice and your decision, and also being a healthy woman with medical complications such as diabetes, maybe obesity, if you have problems with your labors where there's a problem with your pelvis.
In other words, it's not large enough or some other issues there.
Correct, that you are not able to pass a baby through your pelvis, that will risk you out of being a candidate.
How about if you've ever had any other kind of uterine surgery?
Depending on the uterine surgery and where it was located. Obviously, if you've had some major uterine surgery, you are most likely not a candidate for a VBAC. However, if you have had maybe a fibroid removed on the outside of your uterus, there's a possibility that this is okay for you to try.
So that won't throw you out of the ballpark.
Does not necessarily throw you out. And again, it's a conversation you need to have with your provider.
I also read somewhere that it's crucial, if you're going to consider this, that there must be a physician on site who can monitor your labor and, if necessary, perform an emergency C-section, and also an anesthesiologist as well.
Correct. We need to have a team of specialists who are able to handle an emergency situation. Midwives are very capable of monitoring your labor and determining anything that's in the abnormal or that turns abnormal with your labor. And then we seek our obstetrician surgeon to evaluate you and determine what are the next steps. Do we need to proceed with a C-section, or are you stable enough to continue with your labor?
So basically, there's got to be an obstetrician on site, somewhere on site, who is capable of performing an emergency C-section if you're going to consider this.
Correct.
Vaginal delivery.
As well as an anesthesiologist in-house, yes.
So on the whole, is it safe to try?
It is safe to try as long as you are a candidate and that you have the reassurance of the safeties that each hospital will offer, that such as the anesthesiologist, as well as the surgical team, as well as an obstetrician, immediately available. And according to American College of OBGYN, immediately available is immediately available. So within the hospital that you have to be there.
So what are the signs that you would look for that would make you think, let's say a woman has begun a trial of labor, what are the kinds of things you would look for? What signs of distress, for example, with the infant or the newborn or the mother? Are those the determining factors?
Usually the biggest sign and the earliest sign that we see during a VBAC attempt or a trial of labor, they call it a TOLAC, a trial of labor after a cesarean called a TOLAC, is fetal distress. That is the first sign.
And that's being monitored.
And that's being monitored, yes. When a mom goes in for a VBAC or a TOLAC, I should say, she is on the monitor continuously so we can take a close look at the contractions as well as the baby's heart.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with Heather Shannon. She's a certified nurse midwife. And we're talking about the safety of a vaginal birth after cesarean section. So what factors, Heather, might work against you? In other words, when you're making this consideration, what are the kinds of things that might work against your having a successful VBAC?
Well, some of the risks are advanced maternal age. If you are an older woman having maybe your first VBAC, there's some risks involved being older.
Is that because the uterus is not as flexible, pliable?
Muscle tone has a lot to do with it. And also, there's some other health conditions. As we get older, we have higher blood pressure. Maybe we're at a higher risk for diabetes. So advanced maternal age, which by definition, it's greater than 35. It doesn't always seem fair, but 35 and older is considered.
Especially these days with so many women waiting to have babies. But
yes.
Okay, that makes sense. How about things like your BMI, your weight?
If you are obese, you are at a higher risk of not being successful to have a VBAC, as well as if you go past your due date. So if you go past 40 weeks, you will have an increased risk of, should we say, failure or lack of success. And also, if you have short intervals between pregnancies, so if it's less than a year between the last pregnancy, then the scar is still pretty fresh from when you had the C-section, and there's a greater chance that you would not be successful.
So overall, what I'm hearing is, no matter what, if you've had a cesarean section, and you're contemplating on this next pregnancy to have a vaginal birth, you really have to have a very long and extensive conversation with your obstetrician to make sure that A, you're a candidate, and B, the center you're going to can really manage it, handle it, and is willing to give you that TOLAC, that trial.
Exactly. And this conversation should be written as well as verbal. So you should have both information that is written as well as verbal, or at least be guided to resources like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists in order to understand your success and also the risks involved.
Speaking of risks, you did mention to me that, there are things that can go wrong, but what exactly are the major, what is the major risk with an attempt?
The major risk is uterine rupture, which means that the scar where the previous C-section had taken place opens during your labor. And it's actually less than 1%. It's about 0.5% if you should go into spontaneous delivery. So it's, 99.5% will be successful in not rupturing their uterus. but less than 1% has the risk.
And is there a danger then to the baby and the mother?
There is a danger, and it's an extreme danger, a life and death situation. And this is where we need to have our emergency services in place at the hospital. So the hospital has to have a clear plan to handle an emergency situation such as this.
Is there also a risk of infection? If you have to have a C-section after you've had a trial of labor?
Yes, there is greater risk. There is a greater risk of infection as well as injury to your insides from the surgery, as well as hemorrhage, possible bleeding, and more scar tissue being developed on the uterus.
I guess what comes to mind for me is, so how does a physician... Or what physicians, how do they feel about them? I mean, your experience as a certified nurse midwife, you're working hand in glove with these physicians. Generally, how do they feel about this trial of labor?
There are mixed feelings out in the community. There are some who really support VBAC, a TOLAC, a trial of labor. And then there's some who that's not part of their practice, and they have the opportunity to refer these patients who are interested in a trial of labor and proceeding with a VBAC to those providers who will provide VBAC services.
You know, so many women have heard of the term midwife. I mean, it's been around for centuries, but I think today's midwife is not like your grandmother's midwife. So tell us about what it means to be a certified nurse midwife.
That's right. Today's midwife is not like your grandmother's midwife. We are one of the oldest professions in the world, and we've practiced all over the world. I mean, we're documented in the Bible, and we are known for obstetrical care. Over the past century, actually, we have made a transition where midwives are now providing care that's outside of obstetrics. We are now considered full scope OBGYN providers. So we take care of women throughout the life cycle, from adolescence to menopause and beyond, and we see everything in between.
With what types of issues?
We take care of women who have family planning issues. Maybe they want to get pregnant, maybe they don't want to get pregnant, so we can help them with those decisions. If they have some common women's complaints of irregular periods, painful periods, pelvic pain, maybe some breast abnormalities, or if they have problems with their hormones, we are able to evaluate them and provide medication, hormone replacement therapy.
Do you always work under a physician?
No, New York State does not allow us or does not require us to work under a physician.
So you are licensed by New York State to work independently.
Correct, and certified, and we are independent primary care providers for women under federal law.
So now you work along during a labor and delivery, you'll work with a physician, but basically you can have your own practice of patients. Very quickly, I don't want to run out of time. Where are you located, and how would someone find a certified nurse midwife?
We are located up at the community campus in the physician office building north on the fourth floor. You can go online and look us up and call for an appointment.
And we'll have a link on our website to that. Heather, thanks so much. My guest has been Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and the director of academic midwifery program on the community campus of Upstate Medical University. Up next, what does it really mean to achieve wellness? Stay with us to find out. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here. Well, you know, the entire concept of wellness is more than one that just fits into a medical model of physical health. And joining us with his own concept of what constitutes wellness is Dr. Kaushal Nanavati. He's the Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and he's the Director of the Integrative Medicine Program at Upstate Cancer Center. Welcome, Dr. Nanavati. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So you bring a very special orientation to this whole concept of wellness. Tell us about it.
So the thought is that ultimately in this life we have two choices. You can choose to be at peace or you make the other choice, but it's always your choice. So, you know, I always tell people don't point the finger elsewhere, look within. And the idea of wellness is one that really starts with the individual, with ourself. And that's where I've come up with this idea of these four pillars of wellness, the idea that nutrition, physical exercise, stress management, and the sense of spiritual wellness or peace and contentment are foundation pillars upon which one can be grounded in wellness.
So let's go over these four pillars very briefly when you talk about wellness, because you're saying that all, it's kind of like a holistic or the whole person. It's not really just the kind of medical model.
That's correct. So the conventional medical model has focused a lot on the physical person, and we get into psychology as well. But the idea of the mind, body, spirit, and what in family medicine they call the biopsychosocial model of care, relates to the individual, the family, the community.
And so it's not just the person, it's really where they sit in the
that's
world.
That's right. It's their environment, their network, if you want to call it that, internal and external. So the idea of the four pillars, nutrition, and, you know, we've gone from the food pyramid to the food plate. And Harvard actually has this evidence-based food plate as well.
Explain that briefly.
And there, what they did was basically took what current evidence there is in literature regarding nutrition and how to balance it and came up with a food plate with some guidelines on not only eating but also on fitness. And so with nutrition, it's pretty simple. 7 to 9 servings of vegetables a day, and people think, whoa, there's no way I can get that many in. But if you think about a good-sized salad, that's probably 2 to 3 servings right there. And if you have that with lunch and dinner, you've got close to 6 servings right there. If you snack on some carrot sticks or some broccoli, you've got your 7 to 9. So it's
so
a
plant-based,
matter of,
a lot of plant-based nutrition.
Because there's a lot of benefit from the world of cancer as well as from cardiovascular health and from overall wellness. The idea of getting some fruit, but protein also grounded in things like beans and legumes and lentils, especially when tolerated. You know, if people are going to have meat, and, you know, people do eat meat, then the idea is to have leaner, organic, grass-fed meats that are not supplemented with things that can eventually have a detrimental effect on the
body. And to limit the red meat somewhat.
That's correct. And with red meat, the big thing to understand is that studies that showed a link to colon cancer were directly correlating overcooked red meat with increased risk of colon cancer. So that's one where we have to be careful.
And the same with processed meats. You say try to avoid those.
That's
as well.
Right. And, you know, I use examples, especially of cold cuts, you know, and things like bacon, sausage, ham. Ham tends to be very salty, so for a lot of people that's a problem. With things like bacon, sausage, manufacturing is an issue, and things, you know, such as other infections that may be tied in with them as well.
So go on. So what else in terms of, I know that grains are important. Nuts are a key factor.
Nuts are a key. And in fact, in the Mediterranean diet, when they did a retrospective analysis, what they found was that it wasn't necessarily the red wine and the fish that showed the greater benefit over time, but it was the legumes.
Really?
And even the nuts that had a benefit, specifically the legumes. So
legumes meaning beans.
Beans, obviously. That's right. So, you know, all kinds of beans have a lot of value, and depending on how we prepare them, how we cook them, rice and beans is a great combination to get essential amino acids that are found also in dairy, which as people get older, they don't always tolerate due to lactose intolerance.
Do you think that vegetarians and vegans can be as healthy, if not more healthy, than people who are carnivorous?
I think it's definitely possible to be as healthy. You know, some of the studies show that in terms of inflammation in the body, the plant-based diets actually help to reduce inflammation in the body, where some of the animal-based proteins may be pro-inflammatory, depending on how they're prepared. So from that perspective, it's definitely possible.
In fact, it even suggests it may be healthier.
That's correct, especially from cardiovascular and even oncologic perspective.
And you also mentioned that you need to drink a lot of water.
That's right. I mean, water is, you know, an essential necessity in our body anyway. And oftentimes people, especially in our society, tend to drink juice and soda and that sort of thing. And the one thing I tell people is I'd rather you ate the fruit than drank the juice, because you get the fiber. And the fiber not only has a cleansing benefit, but it has anti-cancer properties as well, cardiovascular benefit as well. And not such a concentrated sugar base, which then tends to lead to other problems.
So you also say that we should avoid products that are white flour based as well? You want to try to use whole grain products.
So the idea with that is that when they're processed containing white flour, the body actually doesn't respond as well to it in the long term. And again, it has a pro-inflammatory benefit. Whole grains have a benefit not only from the lipid profile, cholesterol benefit, but also cardiovascular and also in terms of nutrient value.
So what about physical exercise? We hear this over and over again. This is part of your pillar. Why is it important, and should it be daily?
So physical exercise, you know, it should be a daily appointment, actually. Most of us live on schedules that are, you know, we go to work on time, we clock in, we clock out, and yet exercise is something that people always say, well, I'll get to it. And the point is, we should try to make it daily. You know, the national agencies that recommend exercise talk about anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes, some say up to 45 minutes, and you know, whether it's continuous or even 15 minutes 2 to 3 times a day, the point is there's a lot of value.
Yeah, there was something that we've been reading and talking about even on this show, that newer research has suggested that even if you stretch out smaller aliquots or smaller segments of exercise, it's as beneficial as one long push.
That's right, because what you're actually doing is when you're exercising, you're not only doing the physical aspect, but you're giving the heart, you're giving your vasculature, you're giving all your muscles that increased tone, increased blood flow, which gives increased oxygen and gives them vitality. And there's a psychological benefit to exercise in terms of de-stressing.
So let's talk about stress. So that's the next. So just to review, we've talked about all the nutritional things that we've been hearing a lot about. The Mediterranean diet, the grains, the whole grains, not red meat, you know, the water, the dairy, some degree. And then physical exercise, the importance of that on a daily basis in whatever capacity you can do it. And now, how does that all influence stress management, and why is that important?
Well, so stress is something that we all have in our life. And the way to kind of dissect that is to think about stress in two forms. Things that you can do something about, things that are not yours to control. And for many people, I'll give them a simple exercise. Make a list of all your stressors. On a separate sheet of paper, make two columns. Things that I can do something about, things that I can't control. And then you look at it, and the things that you can do something about, deal with it out in front of you rather than letting it penetrate. Because once it gets into the mind, and then we're constantly ruminating about it. So if you can make an action plan and get it off your plate, you do that. If it's something that's not yours to control, it goes on the shelf. It's in your life, but it's not something that you're going to get off the shelf. And at any time your mind is focused on things on the shelf, get back to the list that you can do something about and work on that so that you're actively reducing manageable stress in your life.
I think that's wonderful advice. That's a very interesting concept of how to do it, too. And have you found that patients have been able to adapt to that or adopt that method?
Yeah, actually, when I first started telling people this, I had one lady who brought in a 5-page summary of all her stressors. And in our 15-minute appointment, obviously, we couldn't get to all of it. But the point was, she vested her time in looking and reflecting on her own life and reflecting on the things that she felt were out of balance. And that's the first place to start, is to know where you are, to really reflect, you know, realistically about where your life is, because if you don't know where you are, how are you going to know where to go?
I think that's key.
And that has value.
That's wonderful. And finally, this whole notion of peace and contentment is part of the fourth pillar, which clearly I think most people want in their lives. But how do you achieve it? What are the steps?
Right. So that's one where, you know, my feeling is simple. Peace begins within. And the idea is, if you can understand what peace means to you, and it's a very individual definition. So first, taking the time to reflect, and even doing simple deep breathing exercises 5 to 10 minutes a day, where you're focused on the breath, but you let your mind wander. And as your mind does, thoughts will come in and out, and all you have to do is just focus on the breathing. And what eventually happens is, as we subconsciously declutter, we start to get a clearer picture of who we are as a person and what that definition of peace is. Now, once I can achieve peace for myself, it's much easier for me to go towards peace in couplehood, right? Because if my partner can do the same, now we're both understanding what it means to have peace in our couplehood. And then children, then parents, then extended family and friends, and then everyone else. And the thought is that if the outer spheres are affecting your inner peace, you have to reprioritize.
When you talk about this notion of spiritual wellness, peace and contentment, and giving the example of focusing on your breath, which is clearly a meditative approach, if you're talking to a layperson who's never done this, what do you recommend to them in terms of how they can institute this in their lives? Do you recommend 5 minutes a day? Give us an example.
So I usually tell people start off with 10 minutes. That's a good way to do it. And just focus on the breath. You don't have to chant Om, or it does not have to be denominational.
Doesn't have to have religious content.
Absolutely not. Focus on the breath. Focus on the thoughts. Let the thoughts come. Don't block them out. If your, you know, kind of brow is, you know, tense, that's not the point. You want to focus on the breath and just be in the moment. Be present in that moment, not yesterday, not tomorrow, here and now.
And just keep going back to the breath in a very gentle way.
That's correct.
And you think this is part of what, again, brings peace to someone over
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely.
But it needs to be done regularly.
It's a practice start, right? Peace is something that once you figure out what it is, you have to hold on to.
Well, I'm going to have you back to talk more about that at a later date, but I want to thank you for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Kaushal Nanavati, Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Know that when you bite into leafy greens, you may also be getting a helping of banned pesticides? Well, in this week's Healthy Eats segment, Terry Podolak, Upstate nutritionist, is here with us with the latest news on the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. Hey, Terry, how are you today?
Hi, Linda. Good, thank you.
So, Terry, what do we mean when we say Dirty Dozen and Clean 15?
The Dirty Dozen is a list of the highest foods, a list of 12 foods that have the highest pesticide content that was looked at. These foods were analyzed.
By the group, what is the group, the Environmental Working Group, the EWG?
Yes, it's the nation's leading health and research advocacy organization that scientifically looks at our produce, again, to decrease our risk of pesticide exposure.
You know, I read somewhere that they literally rank the pesticide contamination on 48 popular fruits and vegetables, and that's based on an analysis of more than 28,000 samples that are tested by the USDA and the FDA. So, obviously, they just came out with their newest updated 2013 Shopper's Guide.
Yes, and you can get that just by going to their website, the Environmental Working Group website.
We'll also have a link on our website, healthlinkonair.org. So as we go through talking more about this, if any listener wants to actually see what these 12 plus now, Dirty Dozen are, and the Clean 15. But tell me something. What are the kinds of issues around pesticides? Why is that a problem?
We really want to look for organic foods. And organic foods mean that they're not grown with any synthetic pesticides or fertilizers. Pesticides are a concern to our health because they are linked to causing disease, particularly cancer. The other thing with pesticides is when our fruits and vegetables have pesticides on them and the pesticides are in the soil, it actually decreases the biological activity or the good things in our soil that we need, that the plants need. So when the plants don't get the good material from the soil that they need, they are less nutritious. So,
yeah, I read somewhere that crops that are grown with fertilizer and some of these pesticides, they grow more quickly, but they have less time to accumulate the nutrients.
Exactly.
So they're not nutrient rich in
exactly.
the same way. And how about the fact that when fruits and vegetables have pesticides, I mean, fruits and vegetables do not have pesticides, they become in a way more vigorous because they have to defend themselves.
Yes,
so
it's like
healthier.
They have better immune systems in themselves. And then when we eat those foods, it's like a web of life, then we get the better nutrients or what they call as phytochemicals that help us build our immune system. So yes, our plants are much stronger when they're not grown with pesticides.
So very quickly, I know we're not going to run through the whole thing. What are some of the Dirty Dozen and what are some of the Clean 15?
A few of the Dirty Dozen are apples, celery, cherry tomatoes, and a few of the Clean 15 are those that may have the skin on them, like sweet corn, melons, avocados, things that you need to peel.
Right. Okay. So those obviously, so those peels kind of are some kind of a barrier then, I guess, to the pesticides. But with apples, clearly you've got a thick skin, but it maybe even allows it to be held in there and
stay
as part of the flesh.
You can wash. It does wash some of the pesticide residue, but there's still maybe a little bit. So wash well. And if you can't afford these organic foods, it's still much more important, though, to eat your fruits and vegetables versus processed foods.
Yeah, and maybe get to the local farmers markets this time of year.
Exactly, or grow your own. And please ask.
You mean ask if you were at a farmer's market if it's been grown with pesticides.
Right.
Thanks, Terry. Next up, what kind of special support can reduce the struggle of living with COPD? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for July 29th. This week's tip is take health to go. Don't let your good habits disappear while eating out. There are plenty of healthful options available in restaurants like grilled entrees instead of fried, simple salads with dressings on the side, and extras like broth-based soups and steamed veggies. Remember that the customer is always right, so don't be afraid to order exactly what you need to stay healthy. Look at your schedule this Monday and see if you're eating out this week. Take some time to research the restaurant's menu online or look up some healthy options in that culinary tradition. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Over 30 million people in the U.S. have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. It's a serious lung disease that usually causes breathing to get worse over time. COPD includes chronic bronchitis, emphysema, or both, and can truly affect one's quality of life. But there are treatments that go beyond medicine alone. Here with more on this are Joseph Sorbello, Associate Professor and Chair in the Department of Respiratory Therapy Education in the College of Health Professions at Upstate Medical University, and Roy Van Order, the co-founder and director of the Central New York COPD Alpha 1 Support Group. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
So I'm going to start with you, Joe. Tell us, what exactly is COPD?
Well, as you said, Linda, these include chronic bronchitis and emphysema, and these are called obstructive diseases. And what happens in the lungs is that the chronic irritation, usually caused by smoking, will cause a lot of chemical reactions to happen, which break down the airways, make them very irritated, produce a lot of mucus, for instance, and shortness of breath. And that usually is coming from the changes that take place in what we call the alveoli, where the oxygen goes in and the CO2 comes out. And that's one of the functions of the lung, the main function. So the oxygen level drops slowly over a long period of time, and eventually the carbon dioxide builds up because the people can get the air in but not get the air out. So there's a lot of what we call air trapping.
Tell me when you make the distinction between bronchitis and emphysema. Can you help us understand the differences?
Yeah, most people have aspects of both. Emphysema actually means extra air, and that air is trapped in the airways because the airways close sooner on exhalation than they should because they become very floppy. Chronic bronchitis is just what it says, is that there's a chronic inflammation of the bronchi, and there's a lot of mucus that's produced. And
to interrupt you, the bronchi, again, are those the big tubes that kind of branch out of the trachea and hit each lung? Is that what we're thinking?
Yeah, it is a tree. We call it the bronchial tree. So if you turned a tree upside down, you would basically have what the lungs look like and distributing the air. So, those go to the alveoli, and that's where the gas exchange takes place.
So the alveoli are little air sacs then, or little sacs within the lungs that allow the air to come in and the oxygen to then be distributed to the blood vessels and go into the rest of the body.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. And those alveoli are malfunctioning, basically.
Yes, and in emphysema itself, in pure emphysema, the alveoli actually are destroyed. And that's what creates a lot of the air trapping. So instead of having a bunch of dense grapes, if you will, that's usually how it's depicted, you have an empty space. And those spaces together create larger spaces. So the air goes into a cave, pretty much. And
has no mechanism for coming out.
Some comes out, some stays trapped.
Some limited, yeah.
So a lot of people with COPD have what we call barrel chest.
So, Roy, you are someone who has COPD.
That's correct.
Yes. What kind of symptoms do you experience?
Well, the main one is shortness of breath, incredible shortness of breath. The second one, because of that, is lots of fatigue.
Is that because your body's not getting sufficient
right,
oxygen?
Right, it's just not getting enough oxygen. Stairs are my biggest bane. Going down are fine. Coming up is almost like climbing Mount
Everest.
Olympus.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the main problems for most of us is the fact that we, unless we really work hard at it, do not have the quality of life that everybody else has and causes stress.
So let me get back to causes.
Yes.
First of all, you said it gets worse over time.
Yes.
And you said initially that there's some exposure to something like smoking. Is smoking the major reason for it?
Yes, it is.
Chronic smoking?
Yes. But there's also, fumes if you work in an environment or have
occupational
worked in an
environment. Occupational
exposures. Type of thing. And then there is a genetic form where it's a loss of what we call alpha-1 antitrypsin. So that is a
so that
a
you
cause.
Can just inherit that and
yes.
end up with it.
And that may be about 5 to 10% of the population, maybe a little bit more.
So the majority of people really contract it or develop it as a result of long-term smoking.
Absolutely, but what
or some occupational thing.
Right.
I remember reading somewhere that some people, for example, who do a lot of barbecue cooking over a lot of smoke inhalation, that can also cause it as well. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that the heart and the lungs work together so that the fatigue that's felt is really due also to the heart. And it puts a tremendous workload on the heart. And so you end up not only with lung failure, but also impeding the heart function as well.
So you can have, basically, can you have cardiac problems as a result
yes,
as well?
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Link on Air, and I'm here with respiratory therapist Joseph Sorbello and Ray Van Orden, and we are talking about COPD and what the symptoms are and what can be done about it. How is it diagnosed?
The formal diagnosis is made by what we call spirometry, and that is a pulmonary function testing. And there are certain criteria that have been set up both by the European and the American thoracic societies. And those are very specific criteria that physicians, therapists, nurses, et cetera, follow in order to diagnose.
You give a patient a spirometry test,
right,
which is vital capacity.
And we do it at the State Fair every year. You basically inhale and blow into a tube, and that tells us quite a bit about what's going on. But the other thing that's very important is your medical history. And as Roy alluded to, the shortness of breath and the fatigue, those are very important symptoms for us to know, because then we start getting into the history and see what the cause is so that we can treat it.
Roy, how did you determine, or when did you first realize, first of all, were you a smoker?
Oh, very heavy smoker, absolutely.
How many years?
Oh, probably a good 20.
20 pack years, or 20 years of how many?
Well, I almost embarrassed to mention this. Toward the end of my smoking history, I was up to around 4 or 5 packs a day.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So when did you become aware, or how did you become aware that you had COPD?
Well, I actually didn't know initially. I just said, well, getting a little out of breath, you know, maybe that's just age. But you put it aside. It wasn't severe. But I went in for back surgery, and it was the first time I had a chest x-ray in, it seemed like, years. Now, my doctors never suggested that I had a problem. It was the anesthesiologist that came up the night before back surgery and chewed me out, saying, you know, I shouldn't even be going in for it with the shape that my lungs are in, because general anesthetic does not work well. Well, obviously, everything worked fine. And I went to my doctor, and then he says, oh, yeah, you've got emphysema. And that was in 1991.
Wow.
I quit smoking.
You did?
Oh, yes.
Wonderful. Yeah.
But that's how.
But your symptoms didn't abate completely.
No. It's slowly over a period of time. One thing about COPD for most people, it slowly creeps up on you to the point where you really know you have something.
So many people can do just what you did, which is ignore it or attribute it to some cause.
It is probably one of the most undiagnosed diseases there is right now.
Really?
Yeah, you can go a long time before you realize that you've got a problem. And your general physician doesn't necessarily diagnose it. Mm. And that's why we've always pushed for spirometer tests, because I never got one until I went and seen a pulmonologist, which is years later.
So if there's any kind of suspicion, or if you have a history of smoking, I guess what you're recommending is that every smoker should have a spirometry exam.
That's what
How often is that, like annually?
Should be an annual thing. In fact, you can get it free at the state fair. Our state society has a booth there, and we'd gladly help you with that and give you some advice.
I don't want to run out of time. Right now, what kind of medical treatments are available for people with COPD? You see on TV all the time this and that and these types of drugs, but what do you think?
There are wonderful medications, and they have combined some of the medications and what we call combination therapy is a good thing. But I believe that the best thing is for people to realize that attitude will determine your altitude, and that you can do something. It's, you know, oftentimes our society says you can't. But doing things like joining Roy's group.
Oh, I want to get to that in a minute.
But another thing is pulmonary rehabilitation. And in there, you not only learn about techniques and exercise and how to maximize what you have, you can actually slow down the progression of the disease. And it's very uplifting. So your attitude and your knowledge, having the knowledge, is a very important thing.
So there are actual medical, you know, medicines that can actually help, but what you're advocating here is actually going for some kind of therapy.
Yes.
And to actually teach you how to maximize what your limitations may be.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how does somebody find out about that?
You can certainly ask your physician. I can tell you right now, as Roy has alluded to, talk to your pulmonary physician if you're seeing one. If you're not, you should be referred to one. And there is, to my knowledge, only one pulmonary rehab program in the area sponsored through St. Joe's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And they have a wonderful program. And you work with respiratory therapists and nurses and physicians, and it really is very comprehensive.
Well, now I want to get to the other thing, and one of the main reasons we asked you to join us, Roy, and that is you started a support group. Tell us about it. When did it start? I don't want to run out of time, so tell us, when did it start, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
About 4 years ago, my co-founder, Lucy LaDuke, started a support group for Alpha Ones. And Tony and I attended the first meeting.
What's Alpha 1 mean?
I can never pronounce
it. Alpha 1 antitrypsin is a substance in the body. If you have a deficiency of that, the enzymes will take over and just eat up the lung tissue and cause the emphysema.
Got it. Okay.
So I got in touch with Lucy when I was at her first meeting, because we had all the material from the COPD Foundation group, which she didn't have. So we combined, sort of combined resources, and here we are today.
So you have, it's been going for 4 years. How often do you meet?
Once a month, third Saturday of every month at the Liverpool Library.
Wow. And can people just, how can people find out about it?
Well, that's one of our problems. We put out flyers by word of mouth.
Is there a phone number that we could mention on the air and put on our website?
Absolutely.
What is that?
It's area code 315-299-4367.
299-4367.
And they can call up and get information on the group, when the meetings are, who the speakers are going to be, and they can also get our...
Schedule. Well, I want to thank you so much, Roy, for coming in and sharing this with us. It's very, very important information. And once again, Joe, always a pleasure to have you here and find
out
more about COPD. My guests have been Joseph Sorbello, Associate Professor and Chair in the Department of Respiratory Therapy Education in the College of Health Professions, that's a mouthful, at Upstate University, and Roy Van Orden. He is the founder, co-founder, and director of the Central New York COPD Alpha 1 Support Group.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and this is Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's Literary Journal, with this week's offering from the Healing Muse. I've brought two poems today. They deal with families caretaking their loved ones. In the first poem, the speaker is a physician, but he is a son watching his father grow older and sicker. In the second poem, a mother is watching nurses care for her son who is unconscious in the hospital. The first poem is When the Doctor's Dad is Dying by Robert Schwab, an emergency room physician from Kansas City. When the doctor's dad is dying. The son plods along, his footfalls fighting the gravity of the situation along the hospital corridor. Pausing at intervals to wait for his father, the son knows this walk tires the man who once worked 6 days a week molding steel into skyscrapers. The son waits, hearing the shuffling behind him, remembering all the times he followed his father across the yard, plastic lawnmower stirring the freshly cut grass clippings, trying to keep up with his hero. The father scuffles along, his sneakers struggling against gravity, pacing himself so he doesn't fall too far behind. He watches his son's back grown broad and strong, remembering when he wore the boy like a backpack on the way up to bed. He labors, falling behind, losing ground, remembering what it was like to walk 10 stories up all day long, never tiring, never afraid, never thinking of the day when he would no longer be able to keep up with his son. The son waves and nods to his students who call him teacher, to his patients who call him doctor, wanting to tell them that he can be neither just now, that for this moment he is only a son. And then he stops, turns, and looks, just as his father stops and looks, and their eyes race across 30 years of unspoken love, carrying the message that neither can speak nor bear to hear. It is not supposed to be this way. The second poem is by K.B. Kintzer. She's writing as a mother, watching the nurses who care for her son in the hospital. Her poem is called The Other Mothers. They arrive in uniforms of gray, pink, and blue, the colors of dusk, of dawn, patterned like flocks of birds lifting from water to sky, rustling about the room, straightening sheets, plumping pillows, untangling tubes hanging from IV poles that chirp, whir, and tether the bed, a boat floating, trying to drift from this pastel shore. A blur of movement, they bob and turn in short, swift steps, check charts, temperature, administer meds, and let his mother brush Vaseline over cracked, swollen lips. Let her comb his hair, massage cream into his hands, his feet. Let her stay at the foot of the bed. They wash his body but cover him as they go, before and after, to expose nothing to janitors swabbing floors, removing trays, emptying trash cans. They support his head, his arms and legs with pillows and blankets just so, for they've practiced at home, sprawling for hours on couch cushions and foam bolsters. Slats of sunlight enter the room, row slowly across the floor, fade. At night, his mother watches them lift and turn her son to face the window, always east.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore how to recognize the symptoms and the treatments for stroke. Also, we'll explore predicting post-traumatic stress disorder in servicemen and women. Now remember, if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. And don't forget, if you missed any of today's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website by going to HealthLink on Air, that's one word, healthlinkonair.org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.